Welcome to Columbus Perspective, a weekly public affairs presentation of The Fan. I'm Kate Burdett. Coming up, 12% of all Central Ohio physicians are doctors of osteopathic medicine. Jay Fox has more on how that number is growing, along with the number of educational institutions that train them in our area. Jay will also speak with experts on financial education for teens and on anxiety. Plus, Doug Petcash from Face the State will have a look at state politics. First up on Columbus Perspective.
Columbus is home to several renowned hospital systems. We even have the Ohio State University Medical School. But despite all of this, there's a doctor shortage in Columbus and Central Ohio, especially when it comes to primary care. Dr. Robert Kane, president and CEO of the American Association of Colleges of Osteopathic Medicine, joins us now on Columbus Perspective to discuss osteopathic medicine and how the DO pathway prepares future physicians while helping expand access to primary and preventive care across the country. Thanks for being with us today.
Thank you for having me.
So for those who might not know, give us a definition of osteopathic medicine, because when I hear it, I think of the triangle, but not everybody knows what that is either.
Well, maybe one of the first things to point out is that there are two medical degrees in the United States, DO and MD. Both are fully licensed to practice medicine and surgery independently and without restriction across all states. But one degree, what's taught in colleges of osteopathic medicine, or COMS, I might refer during your conversation, brings you a different perspective on the way medicine should be taught and practiced. And that difference is really in our mindset, methods, strategies, and structures for medical education. What you're going to find in an osteopathic medical education is that we heavily emphasize the person in front of you, making sure that our students understand that whole person approach to care is critical to really moving towards health and for a preventive mindset to occur. So we think about mind, body, spirit. The other two things, it emphasizes the body's own ability to heal itself. We have to provide it with right conditions, sometimes through surgery and medications, but that inside us, there's a lot of great machinery to help promote health overall. And finally, it recognizes that our body's supporting structures, our bones, our muscles, our joints, play an important part in maintaining our health. And so we learn to use manual manipulation, the use of our hands, to help promote that as part of the health process around the supporting structures.
I don't want to start a war with our Ohio State University folks, but why is this not a degree that's offered at Ohio State?
That's a really challenging question to answer. You know, medicine back in the late 1800s moves in two directions. The MD degree, which is I'll call more of a reductionist mindset. It tends to break the body down into smaller parts and to think about how those work together. Ours, I call a complexivist mindset. How do they work together? The truth is, they complement each other, and together we hopefully create a much more complete healthcare system. We like to think that ours is incredibly important to the side of health promotion, and that's why you see a lot of our graduates entering primary care.
Where would one go to get this type of training as opposed to the other type of medical degree called MD?
So our schools are growing in number. There are currently, as of last week, actually, 73 locations across 36 states in the United States. In Ohio, Ohio University is the home of the College of Osteopathic Medicine, the Heritage College of Osteopathic Medicine. It actually has three campuses. The main and first campus is in Athens. Two others, one in Dublin and one in Cleveland, that allow us to train osteopathic physicians for the state of Ohio.
When we talk about the training that they receive, and we've talked about the correlation between mind, body, and spirit, energy, manipulation, self-healing, what is the difference in the medical training with those that are pursuing an MD?
So it's, again, it goes back to that idea of mindsets, methods, strategies, and structures. So in teaching anatomy, human anatomy is going to be taught in similar ways across both schools. But how are we going to integrate that anatomy into understanding the use of our hands and the manual care that we're taught to do? That adds about an additional 250 hours of classroom and laboratory-based education to learn those skills. The other is, again, the approach. What types of role models do you put in front of your students trying to get a certain kind of end product? How do you work towards that complexivist mindset? As I said, how things work together as a whole rather than constantly breaking them down into the smaller parts. That's happening in the classroom setting, in particular the first 2 years. As we move into then our clinical experiences, one of the other things that is very different for most osteopathic medical schools, unlike our MD counterparts that typically are going to do a significant portion of their clinical training in one large academic center in one city, we use a distributed model of medical education. We put our students out into the communities where we ultimately want them to serve and to practice. So they begin to learn what it's like to live in those settings and to practice in those settings. If you look at CMS data, 80% of healthcare is not delivered in those academic health centers. It's delivered in the other hospital systems across the country. So we place our students into those locations to complete their clinical education and to integrate all that knowledge they acquired in the first 2 years.
Does this help with the growing concern that rural areas have as they face lots of funding challenges and issues with federal and state budgets? Does this help the rural physician shortage?
Well, we think we have data to show that it does. And it really, again, going back to that sort of strategy to how things work, our schools very commonly are looking for students that come from those areas. We know things like if you accept students from communities of under 10,000, they tend to have a reason to go back to those types of communities. And so our schools use a draw from, train in, retain in model. The idea that we take you to Athens and then we send you back to Dayton or another community to try to get you to be attracted and interested in practicing in those areas. HCOM has done a great job. 64% of its graduates have stayed in the state of Ohio, and 18% are actually practicing in rural areas. So I mentioned Athens, Dublin, Cleveland. As you look across the country, over half of our schools are located in underserved areas, in designated underserved areas, and over half actually are adjacent to counties or communities where 20% of the individuals living there are designated to be in rural areas. So again, put students into those areas, let them experience those areas, and we end up with data that show we're doing a good job keeping them there.
Now, our research shows in the state of Ohio that there appear to be more than 8,500 DO physicians, making up roughly 12% of our physician community. Is this number low, high, or about equal compared to other states?
So that's about the national average right now. Osteopathic physicians make up just about 12% of physicians in the United States who are practicing. But it's important to keep in mind our growth, and that's what's exciting about osteopathic medicine, is our significant growth. About 40% of medical students today in the United States are earning the DO degree. So you're going to see that 12% start to grow significantly in the years ahead.
How does this impact the insurance concerns with regard to coverage and potential changes to Medicare and Medicaid? Is a DO visit covered?
Absolutely. As I mentioned in the beginning, fully licensed to practice medicine and surgery, unrestricted in all 50 states.
Okay. So what is forcing this trend towards increased choice of becoming a DO versus an MD? What are the students saying is motivating them to take this path?
You know, I think what we've seen in the healthcare system at large is that there's a shift in mindset for patients of wanting to focus more on prevention, of wanting more access to primary care, of a need for compassion and caring in the experience, right? That the person sitting in front of you cares about you and is focused on you first. Sort of that leading with the heart and letting the science follow mindset. And that helps to develop a more trusting relationship. So I think students today are able to look at a couple of things. Well, that's a growing interest among Americans in terms of how healthcare is delivered. And this degree is very focused on that and has been since its founding back in the 1890s. It's not a new development or a trend. It's the way we've practiced since the very beginning. The fact it's growing, and that in and of itself is exciting to see the growth, that there are more schools closer, oftentimes to their home, which offer them an option to enter osteopathic medicine. So hopefully it's that multiple things are allowing them to look at this and say, this is a good pathway for me. I'm really interested in being a physician's servant, and this pathway is well designed to do that.
We are finally beginning to realize as a society that when the brain is healthy, our body tends to have a better chance of being healthy. And we're paying far more attention to mental health now than we have at any time in my lifetime. To what degree is mental health training a part of the DO educational process?
Well, I'll take that back to the original answer about the focus on the whole person and mind, body, spirit. So I practiced for many years as a pulmonary physician before becoming an academic leader. And because of my training as an osteopathic physician, understood that I couldn't just focus on the symptoms, the respiratory symptoms that the patient was having, because often there were other drivers happening in that individual's life, other concurrent diagnoses like anxiety or depression, that if we didn't address those two, we weren't going to get the best outcome for that patient. So if your goal is, did I reduce that patient's symptoms and they're no longer complaining of them, that's one thing. If your goal is, I want to make this person realize their greatest health potential, to make them as functional as possible, then you have to pay attention to those. And that is integrated throughout the educational process as well.
So that's two out of three. Let's get to the third part of the triangle, which is spirit. Have you encountered any resistance from people's religious practices? For example, the Christian Science religion has an entirely different take on the body and how medicine works, and some Eastern religions also have different takes. How is that incorporated into all of this?
I can't say I've specifically had conversations with patients in a negative way that has impacted care. I think that the idea is spirituality comes through many pathways for individuals, and that really comes back to taking the time to get to know the person in front of you so that you can understand their needs and their expectations of your care.
So what I'm hearing you say is respect for the individual and empathetic, open, and honest listening.
Yes.
Okay, so let's go back to the students. What should a student know if they're considering an osteopathic medical school?
What specifically are you looking for in that question?
What I'm looking for is, first and foremost, do they have to have the same basic general education requirements as one would go through medical school? Do they have to take the MCATs? What is the process? Is it just the same, or is there something different?
So students should always try to understand the schools they're applying to. So whether it be looking at an individual school's website or trying to find information that's available through our application service called ACOMAS. But that will help to outline, are there any specific things that a given school is looking for in an individual? In general, to become a physician, period, in the US, you need a strong understanding of science and math to be able to function well in the role. So typically, those are going to be part of the prerequisites. But we also see a growing interest in the other things that are important to be a good physician. Can you communicate well? And can you read and write well? Things that are important to, again, connecting to that individual who is in front of you. Yes, you will need to take the medical college admissions test. In order to be considered typically by the osteopathic medical schools. But it is important to keep in mind, we have a growing effort and even a project currently underway through the association to deliver a much more holistic review so that we truly understand that person in front of us as well. We want to make a good match as they come into our profession so that they're able to continue the things that we've been talking about on this call.
Over the last 15 years, there's been a trend towards an increase in what is being referred to as concierge physician service, where an individual who is a doctor has a clinic and his patients pay a membership fee and they have certain privileges and perhaps even, you know, at-home visits. The old, family doctor shows up at the house. Does this medical pathway lend itself to that?
Well, absolutely. You know, as I've mentioned, it's the license that you ultimately will end up with after completing your training and your licensure examinations is unrestricted. You will complete graduate medical education in order to get that license. And so between those two things, you should be well prepared for a wide range of practice. And of course, what you're talking about with concierge medicine is a response to some of the challenges that we're seeing in the healthcare system, both for the individual physician, who perhaps an employee role didn't fit well into what they want to see in practice. And so they seem to have more control or feel they have more control and can better meet their patients' needs. And so, yes, that is certainly a pathway open to graduates after they're licensed.
This has been a fascinating conversation, and unfortunately, we're out of time. But if our listeners want to do a deeper dive on the subject, what's the best website that we can send them to?
So our association, the American Association of Colleges of Osteopathic Medicine, supports our colleges of osteopathic medicine in terms of programs and services, and we serve as the national voice for osteopathic medical education. That website is aacom.org. There you can find information about osteopathic medical education, osteopathic medicine, application services if you are a student, and other information as well, like our recent impact report that we've completed on our colleges to better understand how we're affecting the U.S. healthcare workforce and the local economies where our schools operate.
This has been an absolutely fascinating conversation. We thank Dr. Robert Kane for joining us this morning. And for Columbus Perspective, I'm Jay Fox.
The Fan.
You're listening to Columbus Perspective on The Fan. Here's Jay Fox.
Columbus City Schools estimate that over 3,000 students will graduate high school this year. The question needs to be asked, are they prepared for life? The answer may surprise you. Dr. Billy Hensley, president and CEO for the National Endowment for Financial Education, joins us now on Columbus Perspective to discuss the national shift towards graduation standards and what effective financial education should include in 2026 and beyond. Good morning and welcome.
Good morning. Thank you for having me.
It's our pleasure. Dr. Hensley, are high school students financially prepared for life after graduation?
Well, what I can say is that we're doing a better job. You know, we've surveyed those who have taken financial education classes, and 86% consider it very valuable. They're happy they took the class. And those who didn't wish they did, with 82% saying, hey, I wish someone had required me to take this class. And those who didn't, 70% believe the quality of their financial life would be better. So this, you know, this is an essential topic. And it's the same across the country. 83% of Americans believe their state should require a semester or year-long course. With financial education actually at the top of that list, 76% believe it is among the most essential classes, virtually tied with math and just a little above English.
So I'm of a certain age where we had something called home economics, and we learned a variety of things about life after school, including how to balance a checkbook and how to pay bills. What happened to those programs?
Well, things sort of come and go. 150 years ago, 120 years ago, math actually covered personal finance. And then home economics came along, and then that evolved into consumer science. And, you know, it really just is about what is being asked for locally and what the movement is. And, you know, I don't think there's a single answer about why it stopped being required. But luckily, we're now at 30 states that require financial education as a standalone course, at least a semester to graduate, which is the minimum needed really to cover this topic. And it's highly sought after. It's in demand. People are asking for this. It's very popular on both sides of the aisle in all these states where it's passed, including Ohio. It was nearly unanimous, which is a rarity today. So current modern students want this. We've got great momentum. So we're getting back to where it was, you know, when you were having these courses.
So with regard to Ohio, were we one of the first states to ratify this, or were we at the middle of the pack or the back of the pack? How important was this to the Buckeye State?
Well, you know, Utah was the first all the way back in 2003, and that went into place in 2008. And in 2019, we only had 9 states, but this bubble happened. You know, we started seeing more and more demand for this, and Ohio was at the early stages of that wave as it came through. So you passed your legislation around 5 years ago, and it went into place just lately, with the class of 2026 being the first group of seniors to finish high school with this as a required course.
What do they learn?
Well, it's, you know, it depends on what's happening in the class, but most states have a standard that's what's being covered. What people really want covered, though, is spending and budgeting, saving, earning income, managing credit, investing, you know, saving for the future, saving for retirement, and really importantly, understanding the financial system. You know, we want people to have a very comprehensive financial education, which is why this semester is necessary to cover all these topics in depth, so they have the opportunity to, you know, practice it in a safe environment, so they're ready when they go out into work or higher education or whatever's next for them. They at least have the confidence necessary to begin to navigate some of these financial decisions.
Do the schools have the opportunity to augment their program based on their geography? For example, something might be more appropriate in an urban community rather than in a rural community, and certain things may not be important to either. Can they tweak the program?
Absolutely, and they should be. And, you know, most teachers are really good at this. They know where their students are. They live in those communities. And I personally believe in this, that we're all in a different place. There's a diversity of needs out there. We all bring something different to the table when it comes to money. Some of us have talked about it with our families. Some of us didn't, like me. And so meet those students where they are. And every zip code is going to have different nuance, different needs, and talk about what's locally happening and bring up what students should learn. And believe me, students will also say what they're interested in. You know, they're interested in things that get headlines like Bitcoin and so forth. They want to know more about those things and how to be cautious about that and what does that mean for them personally. So you're right on the money, no pun intended here, about facing this topic.
Do the standards apply just to public schools, or are private parochial and charter schools also required to do this?
It depends on by state, but most of the private schools do follow what the state standards are requiring them to cover. This is the neat thing about this topic. You know, families and communities can reinforce these lessons. They can actually go to the school and hold these educational institutions accountable. So if you are in a private school or even homeschool for that matter, and this is not being covered, then let's approach this topic. Let's talk to the principal. Let's talk to the teachers about getting this topic in the classroom and normalizing this so that we, you know, it's expected.
Because this is such a vital part of life in the United States, in Ohio, in Columbus, should this program be extended to cover other aspects of life? Has this been introduced into the religious community, for example, to reinforce it in Sunday school?
You know, churches actually across the country do a very good job of covering this topic. Some of the best implementation with financial education is happening in faith-based communities. Libraries are also another place where you're seeing financial education programming happening as a service to the community.
And that would be not just for students, but for adults, I would hope.
Right, absolutely. I'm a firm believer that lifelong education with this topic is important because the financial system is going to change. The products are going to change. You know, the things that were available to me in the 90s when I finished college are different than they are now as you finish college. You know, there's a lot of things that keep changing, and so we have to continue to reengage in financial education. It's not a one and done.
Well, here's the million-dollar question, no pun intended on my part. If I'm a parent and I have not had the benefit of this type of education, what resources can I access so that I can better assist my children in handling this material, understanding it, and putting it into practice?
Some of the program providers who provide teaching materials, curricula, and so forth to classrooms also have parent engagement resources as well. And I'm sure the teachers in these classrooms would be happy to share resources, websites, links, materials with the parents as well. One of the things we learned many years ago is that students were taking their workbooks or their lessons home, and the parents became interested as well. And so they were learning alongside the students. So, you know, we have to demystify this topic so that parents, students, all of us are not ashamed to ask questions, not ashamed to advocate for ourselves and what we want to learn and what we want to cover in that classroom.
So, as you said, students in the Columbus Public School System, this is the first year that that course is being offered. So graduating seniors this year will have had the benefit of that education.
Right. There's something like 33,000 students in the Columbus Public Schools. And, you know, my hope is that every one of those students leave Columbus Public Schools with confidence and a basic knowledge about money management so that when they launch into life, they're not stressed out about making the right decisions. You know, I personally felt that when I graduated, and I want to demystify that for every young person in this country.
All right. We want to thank Dr. Billy Hensley, President and CEO for the National Endowment for Financial Education, for joining us this morning. And for Columbus Perspective, I'm Jay Fox.
Columbus Perspective is a public affairs presentation of WBNS Radio. The opinions expressed on this program are those of its guests and do not necessarily reflect those of WBNS Radio, its staff, management, or sponsors.
The Fan.
This is Columbus Perspective on The Fan. Here's more from Jay Fox.
Anxiety is a prevailing problem here in Central Ohio. Concerns about housing affordability, the job market, wages, childcare costs, and immigration enforcement have so many people on edge right now. New data from the American Psychiatric Association and APA Foundation shows the people of Columbus are not alone in terms of feeling rising uncertainty about their future. The study prompted a closer look at habits like sleep, boundaries, and healthier routines, and these concerns shape many people's New Year's resolutions, as people seem to want to feel more grounded. Raul Andrews Jr. is the executive director of the American Psychiatric Association Foundation and joins us now on Columbus Perspective to discuss this new polling, how people can set realistic mental goals for their health, and what free resources are available. Happy New Year, sir.
Thank you, Jay. Happy New Year to you and your audience.
What do the latest survey findings tell us how people felt heading into 2026?
While for some the new year is about a fresh start, still there are a number of folk in the poll who are anxious about tomorrow and what 2026 will look like. And so nearly 4 in 10 Americans in our poll indicated they were going to have at least one mental health-related resolution this year.
Is that up from last year?
up 5 points, about 33% last year, up to 38% in the new year. And that is no surprise to us because uncertainties rise around financial goals, health goals, school changes, job changes, so forth and so on. So we weren't surprised that there was interest in mental health. We were surprised by a big jump up to 5%.
When we think about New Year's resolutions, and obviously we're now in February, and a lot of them have already been broken, but when we think about them, we think about things that are tangible that we can see, like weight loss or change in spending habits. Why did so many people choose mental health this year? And how does that, what does that look like?
Yeah, no, there's connective tissue in all those goals, and I think that's what the 5% jump in the polling is telling us, that people are now recognizing, if I have financial goals, my anxiety around my financial goals ties my fiscal issues with my mental issues. If I have issues around health or physical fitness, that also is connected to I don't like what I see in the mirror. And so there's a mental component to that. And so I think that is what is driving folks to recognize what we've been saying for a while. There is no health without mental health. And there is no good physical health if we don't understand what's going on and how we can get a better state of play for ourselves and the people we care about.
We're starting to have open and honest conversations about things that were taken for granted years ago. One of those things is stress. What are some everyday habits that people can choose to engage in to help manage stress on a daily basis?
Well, when we talk to our doctors at the APA and then we look at this poll, one of the things we're encouraged about is younger adults are leading this movement around whole health and a greater focus on mental health. Adults 18 to 34, nearly 60% said we got to treat the mind and the body in order to get better health goals. But we want folks to be mindful and kinder to themselves. So how do we make sure we're getting adequate sleep? Are we monitoring our diet as we can? Are we engaged in regular physical activity? And when we say physical activity, we recognize that some people have jobs that are very physical. But are you doing something for yourself outside the physical activity of a physical job that can help you? You know, you just get out, walk around, just get moving. Journaling is important. But the other thing that came through, Jay, in our poll, is that people were willing to talk to a therapist or a counselor or a doctor about their concerns if they didn't figure that just journaling it away would get it done for them.
Motivation to continue is always problematic, especially when things don't go right. And one of the things we know is that there are only so many things we can control. So when we talk about issues in Columbus like immigration enforcement concerns or housing affordability or the cost of childcare, for example, those aren't things we can necessarily control. So how do we stay motivated in the face of things like that?
Everything in moderation, whether that's the consumption of news, whether that's the consumption of food and beverage, whether that's the consumption of social media and so forth. We just want to give ourselves a break when we need a break from what is happening around us so we can focus on what we can control. But again, when we talk to our doctors, Jay, at the APA, the one thing that they remind us is that the why now is really important when it comes to resolutions. You made a commitment to make physical fitness a goal or financial health a goal or even mental health, I'm going to go see a therapist, a goal. Why did you say now is the time to do that? And then keep reminding yourself on the good days, on the bad days, and on the blah days about why now. And I think that helps you understand that this whole health, mental health journey is a marathon. It's not a sprint.
One of the things that's important about mental health counseling is teaching the patient coping skills and giving the patient resources for how they can personally manage their own mental health. But not everybody can afford a therapist. So what free resources does the American Psychiatric Association Foundation offer to help those people?
There is a public service campaign that we host called Mental Health Care Works, and it has a free website, mentalhealthcareworks.org, where you can get tools, tips, and resources for free that are vetted by our physician psychiatrists at the APA. And can kind of get you on a roadmap to get you grounded in what are these concerns and how do we navigate them. The other thing we want to encourage folks to do in your audience, if you're struggling now, or you know somebody you care about who might be struggling, the National Crisis Helpline is 988. You can call, text, or chat and talk or text or chat with a real person in your community about tools and tips and resources that could be available, some of which are free. And at least you know what your options are, Jay. And that's how you reduce uncertainty, because if I don't know what my options are, I am afraid of tomorrow. But if I know that there's some options, I may not take them immediately, but I know what my choices can be.
It's always a pleasure to speak with Raul Andrews Jr. from the American Psychiatric Association Foundation. We thank you for listening. And for Columbus Perspective, I'm Jay Fox.
The Fan.
You're listening to Columbus Perspective on The Fan. Now, courtesy of our sister station, WBNS 10TV, here's Doug Petcash from the Sunday morning public affairs program, Face the State. A new edition can be seen this morning at 11:30 on 10TV.
January 21st marked the one-year anniversary of Ohio Senator John Husted being sworn in to the U.S. Senate. Governor DeWine appointed him to take the seat of now Vice President J.D. Vance. On that anniversary, Senator Husted came to the 10TV studio for a wide-ranging interview on world events and big issues playing out inside our country. We talked about ICE operations and protests against them, and all the talk about the U.S. acquiring Greenland. That's where we started. In a speech at the World Economic Forum in Switzerland, President Trump said he would not use military force to acquire Greenland. The president later announced, after meeting with the NATO Secretary General, that they reached a framework of a future deal. I talked with Senator Husted before that framework was announced about the idea of the U.S. acquiring Greenland. He said diplomatic conversations are needed.
I'm not going to interject my thoughts of how those negotiations go yet. There are a lot of strategic assets in Greenland, rare earth and other things that are very valuable. And so there may be a deal to be had, but the bottom line is let's negotiate with our allies. Let's do something that's in the security interest of all of freedom-loving people.
And speaking of allies and NATO, do you have concerns about how this issue may impact U.S. relations with NATO and our allies?
Well, I always have concerns because you need friends in the world, and I believe that the rhetoric is starting to move in the right direction. The president negotiates tougher and uses different terms than a lot of other leaders are accustomed to, but I believe that we're moving in the right direction, that America's interests will be represented, but not at the expense of our allies.
There were nationwide protests and the Free America walkout protests around the country over the Trump administration policies, particularly on immigration and particularly after what happened in Minneapolis. Are senators listening to the protesters, or do you think that these ICE operations should continue the way they are in the U.S.?
Well, I was at the border recently, and I can tell you that in talking to border control officials, they will say that there are between 11 and 15 million people that came into this country, and many of them were not properly vetted. So we have criminals roaming around our streets. They're not raising their hands and stepping forward. And in states like Minnesota and cities like Minneapolis, they're protecting the worst of the worst. 212 people are on that worst of the worst list, murderers, rapists, drug dealers, who have been apprehended in Minnesota during these ICE operations. We need officials, governors, mayors to cooperate so that we don't have chaos, that we can go get the people who are here committing crimes, doing things illegally. And ICE has the responsibility to do that. If you don't like what ICE is doing, you're free to protest, use your First Amendment rights, to appear in court if you think somebody has been illegally detained, but you can't interrupt ICE law enforcement operations. That's when tragic things can happen. We don't need that. Let's obey the rule of law. Let's enforce the rule of law. If we can all agree to that, everything will go just fine.
We hear reports of ICE agents going up to random people and asking for papers and proof of citizenship. Do you think that should be happening?
You can come up with an incident that that did not go well with ICE, and I understand that. When you're doing a massive law enforcement operation, it does not go, every incident does not go smoothly. But let's also be clear that there are agitators who are being paid to interrupt ICE operations, to agitate them. ICE agents have been attacked by civilians and people who are in this country illegally. That is wrong. They are conducting a legitimate law enforcement operation, and instead of obstructing them, Minnesota officials should cooperate and help get these bad guys off the street because they're out there. They're terrorizing neighborhoods, and these are people who've committed murders, who are dealing drugs, who've committed sex offenses against children. They need to be apprehended, and when people are obstructing that, they're obstructing justice.
Again, that's courtesy of our sister station, WBNS 10 TV, from the Sunday morning public affairs program, Face the State. A new edition can be seen this morning at 11:30 on 10 TV. This has been Columbus Perspective, a weekly public affairs presentation of The Fan. Heard each Sunday morning at 6 on WBNS FM 97.1 The Fan and on 1460 AM The Fan 2.